This book, which is out relatively recently, January of this year, Tariffs, Blockades, and Inflation, The Economics of the Civil War. The general theme of the book, although it's not really broadcast hot and heavy throughout the book, but the underlying theme of the book is that economics ultimately determined both the cause of the war as well as its outcome. In contrast to historians of the Civil War, who generally see the war as a matter of military strategy and the outcome of battles, the strategy of generals, we see it entirely different. We see a nation divided roughly equally, and basically the same types of soldiers, the generals trained at the same West Point Academy, using essentially the same weapons, essentially having similar types of economies. And most of the battles, especially at the beginning of the war, were toss-ups, stalemates. One side wins one, the next side wins the other. We think the underlying outcome of the war was determined by economics, where the Confederacy generally pursued poorer economic policies, and the Union government in the North pursued better economic policies, and as a result was able to win. We place a lot of emphasis on blockades, but you can't really do a study of the American Civil War, which is really a defining moment in American history. Still the war where the most Americans died, and it's still the really the only war where the destruction of the war was brought home here to the United States. So it's a very important issue. We think the historians have gotten it largely all wrong. They think the South didn't do enough, didn't have enough, the government didn't extract enough resources from the economy to fight the war, that if they only poured more effort into it, that they could have ultimately won or at least had a stalemate. Now this chapter 3, Inflation North and South, continues that theme. And basically, the underlying theme of this chapter is inflation is bad, and monetary inflation is bad. There's pretty much upfront and sort of describes why inflation is bad in the beginning of the chapter. You know, it's not just rising prices. That's not a problem. And so the beginning of the chapter explains why inflation is bad, why it harms economic calculation, why it causes income redistribution and economic chaos. Now, both sides used inflation, monetary inflation, to finance the war and to disguise the costs of the war. So that's going to be one general argument that we lay out. The second one is that the Confederate government used inflation to a greater degree than the Union government in the North. Third, the Southern economy was more adversely affected by this inflation. And fourth, and this is a very important point, the war had a revolutionary effect on money and banking in the United States. I'm going to start with a little description for you of what existed prior to the war in the United States as far as money and banking goes. Basically, you had two streams of economic thought. One stream of economic thought is sometimes called Southern political economy. It's associated with the Democratic Party of the 19th century. With the ideas of politicians such as Thomas Jefferson and Andrew Jackson. The Southern political economy, although there were Southern and Northern proponents of this, was the hard money faction. These are the people who said money should only and everywhere be silver coins and gold coins. This tradition was anti-banking. They did not like banking. They were very suspicious of it. They thought that it surreptitiously redistributed wealth and was fraudulent. This school of thought was very much anti-government debt, and I associated it with the Austrian school. The other stream of economic thought is labeled Northern Political Economy. This is associated with the Whig Party of the early 19th century, which became the Republican Party right before the Civil War of Lincoln up to this day. Their big proponents were Alexander Hamilton and Henry Clay, and of course Lincoln himself. This was the easy money party, the party of paper money, the party of easy credit that was pro-bank, pro-government debt. It's hard for some of you probably to imagine that someone could come up with an idea, the idea or a backing for the idea that more government debt is a good thing, but this is one of their tenets. And I associate them with the mercantilist school of economic thought. Now, prior to the war, the Southern political tradition, Southern political economy, had the upper hand. And America was a great beneficiary as a result. We had rapid economic growth in the United States from, say, 1800, or maybe from the founding of the nation in the 1790s to the Civil War was a period of tremendous economic growth, particularly in the latter half of that period. Recall that, of course, the U.S. Constitution does two very important things economically. It gives the federal government the power to define money and created a monetary union within the United States, and it prevented state governments from issuing paper money and defining money and that sort of thing. So it created, by default, a nation where Americans used silver coins. It was essentially kind of a private monetary system because the federal government had the power, but they never did anything about it. And the Constitution also established a free trade zone in the United States. Generally, we had free banking laws, and during some periods, there were bank prohibitions. So states would pass laws that says there's no banking in this state, that we, you know, issuing banknotes and that kind of thing. So the only two exceptions to this were the First National Bank of the United States and the Second National Bank of the United States. Those were periods of rapid inflation followed by a crash in the economy and depression. So Americans prior to the Civil War had it relatively good. It was essentially a private money and banking system with very little government intervention. The Civil War is going to change all of that and change it for the worse. If you look at here at this time, inflation and public finance. Wars are very expensive. All wars are very expensive, and governments have to decide or act in such a way as to fund wars. And there are four general ways in which a government can fund war. They can tax the money from the economy, they can borrow the money by using government debt, they can resort to inflation, or they can resort to confiscation and conscription. And Austrians have analyzed all of the ways in which government can raise money and find that taxation is one of the best ways to raise money to fight a war. Makes the cost of the war explicit and upfront, so everybody knows what it's costing, and it also prevents politicians from over-consuming resources from the economy, so that they have to be allocators of scarce resources in the sense of using taxes, because the people know that they're being taxed, and it hurts. It's painful. Borrowing is also seen as a good way of fighting a war. If wars have to be fought, the best way to do it is to borrow money outside of the country and buy goods from foreign countries with those proceeds. So basically the idea here would be to go to Europe, sell bonds to Europeans, and then use the proceeds to buy European goods in order to fight the war. And this somewhat disguises the cost of war, but it makes it easier to fight the war and puts the cost of paying for the war off into the future. Conscription and confiscation, not surprisingly, those turn out to be very poor ways of fighting a war. They make the cost of the war almost too explicit. It falls unevenly on those who get their assets confiscated. It creates opposition to the war. And of course, it discourages the private sector even worse than taxes. Because if you're a farmer or a manufacturer, and you're trying to produce for a profit, and all of a sudden the government comes along and just takes all of your products or takes all of your crops, and there's a good probability that they may do it again, what incentive do you have to produce into the future? And of course, it not only takes resources out of the economy, but it also, if government has the power to confiscate and the power to conscript, they very often use too many resources. So if you can conscript soldiers at will, very often governments will acquire too many soldiers, waste them, i.e. kill them in battle unnecessarily, and of course you're taking them out of the economy, so you're not producing goods. So that's a really bad way. And then we come to inflation. Inflation is the easiest way to pay for war. Governments have gotten very used to the idea of using inflation, but it's the most damaging way to finance war. It's the most damaging in terms of the economy. So politically, it's very good. Economically, it's very, very bad. Politically, you get fewer problems and less opposition. Okay, so in the economic analysis of it, when you look at political interests, what you find is politicians love this, because it disguises the cost of the war. It makes it very easy to raise large funds to spend. It creates very little opposition to the war. People see the money being spent, businesses getting more business, and so they love it. And in this way, governments disguise the cost of war. And Joe Salerno has a great article on how war finance through inflation disguises war and its cost. Of course, inflation does a lot of economic things, distorts prices in the economy, and impairs economic calculation. And this was a tremendous problem both North and South during the war. And of course, because inflation is an easy way to finance war, usually government will take too many resources from the economy and end up wasting them. So whereas historians said that the governments never had enough resources, they failed to tax the economy, they failed to use inflation, they failed to raise enough resources to conscript enough soldiers, our analysis shows that they really, especially in the South, took too many resources out of the economy. In the North, when the Union government sat down to figure out how they were going to pay for the war, they said, okay, we're going to stick to the gold standard, we're going to tax to pay for the war, to pay for government, we're going to use bonds to pay for the war. So they were, they set out on a pretty good course. That lasted about a day. And the next day they said, well, we're going to raise $450 million of greenbacks. We're going to issue a new fiat currency, which we'll eventually redeem. And so their resolve to stick to the good ways of financing the war didn't last at all. And of course, we ended up in the North with a fiat currency and Gresham's Law. All the gold disappeared from the economy, and they were on a paper standard very quickly. The value of the greenback versus gold depreciated by two-thirds during the war. So it lost 65% of its value over a four-year period. In contrast, the value of the U.S. dollar has only fallen about the same amount since we left the gold standard over 30 years ago. So we've had, you know, a pretty good clip of inflation over the last 30-odd years here in the United States. They had that much inflation in 4 years. People felt, politicians argued, that the reason prices were going up, price inflation, was speculators, that businessmen were creating unnecessary profits and driving up prices through devious means. In the northern economy, not surprisingly, there was a lot of chaos with respect to economic calculation. And a lot of things noted by historians were common throughout the United States, especially in the eastern seaboard cities where a lot of the manufacturing and trade occurred. There was the illusion of prosperity, all this new money going into the economy, all these new war contracts created the illusion of prosperity in the North. Property values increased with the inflation, with the monetary inflation, and there were widespread observations of extravagant living and luxury spending. So even though the economy was at war, the monetary injections were able to create the illusion of prosperity and even extravagance and luxury. All the while, in the rest of the population, real wages were declining. So prices were increasing faster than wages, and the vast majority of the population, even though their wages were going up, their real income in terms of the purchasing power that they were able to exert in the economy was falling much faster. And as the war progressed, entrepreneurs started to realize that all the profits that they thought that they were going to make on these contracts and so forth were disappearing. Okay, so they would start projects with the idea that profits were going to be great, but by the end of the war, they realized that they actually were worse off as a result. There's an interesting debate in the economics profession about what causes higher prices. What causes price inflation? And we sort of stumbled through this debate in preparing this chapter, and I think it provides an interesting contrast. For the monetarists, what causes higher prices in the economy? They think it's always and everywhere a monetary phenomenon. So all changes in prices are the result of monetary factors. The Keynesians believe that changes in prices are always the result of real factors. So prices went up for the Keynesians because of real factors in the economy, destroying production, things of that nature, the war effort, and so on. And when we looked at that, we think, well, you know, that's just kind of a strange debate. I think for Austrians, of course, we make the distinction between monetary inflation as the cause and price inflation, or higher prices, lower purchasing power of the dollar, as the effect. What actually causes changes in prices, price levels, purchasing powers, is actually both factors. That you have both the monetary factors and the real factors, so that you can look at both the change in the quantity of money, as well as the real impact of the war, the destruction of capital, the destruction of labor, the diversion of resources from the private economy to the army, as well as anticipations about redemption of paper money. We concluded that the Civil War demonstrates that neither one of the extreme views is really very helpful. Inflation in the South. Well, if you're from the South, you no doubt know that there was a big inflation during the Civil War in the South. Prices of commodities in the South have been estimated to have risen by more than 1,000%, whereas in the North, they went up an estimated 250%. The increase in prices in the South was much greater than the change in the quantity of money. There were some quote-unquote real factors in the South, such as the diversion of resources to the military and the blockade. The blockade, which we discuss early in the book, was a major disadvantage, but the South did, the Confederate government did nothing really to stop. But the South was an economy that was highly dependent upon exports and imports, thrived as a result. And the Union put a ship blockade around the coast of the Confederacy, and the Confederate government did little or nothing to stop it. So trade in the South came to almost to an end. And then, of course, you have subjective factors determining the value of the Confederate currency, such as military defeats and people's expectations regarding ultimately losing the war and the Confederate currency having no value whatsoever. Like in the North, the higher prices were blamed on the speculators and the blockade runners. This is an age-old problem where government inflates the money supply, grabs a bunch of resources, ultimately prices rise, and somehow the burden or the blame for that activity is pointed in the direction of business people, speculators, middlemen, blockade runners in this case. Of course, in the labor force in the South also experiences declines in real income during the Civil War to a greater extent than in the North. And then there's a massive disruption of economic calculation, far worse than the North. Business people basically can't make any sustainable contracts, develop any large-scale business operations, because they can't really determine what their wages are going to have to pay, the prices of materials, and what the ultimate value of their products are going to be, because the monetary disruption is so significant that they can't possibly make reliable estimates of future prices or reliable estimates for the purchasing power of the Confederate currency. So very often, in order to overcome that problem, the Confederate government actually gets into the business of manufacturing weapons, clothing, all sorts of things. So we see, if we look both in North and South, that they're both using paper money inflation, that they're both taking massive amounts of resources out of the economy and into the military, but the South does it to a much greater degree than the North, and we think that this is a contributing factor, probably the most important factor, in why the Confederate government lost. We see the fall in real incomes, disruption of economic calculation, the consumption of capital in both North or South. But the evidence that we found was that all of those things occur to a far greater degree in the Southern economy than in the Northern economy. And I want to go back to the points that I mentioned at the beginning of the lecture with respect to how does a government finance a war? Well, I've got some numbers on the board here. And these represent percentages of how various governments finance the war. So if we wanted to look at the total cost of government during these four governments at war, basically we're talking about 100% of the cost of the war, and that's going to be divided up into loans or borrowing the money to pay for the war, taxes on the economy to pay for the war, inflation, and other ways. And this basically looks at things like confiscation of property, not conscription, but confiscation, and other revenue means. Now, the four episodes here, this is the first one is the Confederate government. Second one is the Union government. The third column is going to be the United States during the American Revolution. And the fourth column is the United States during the War of 1812. Now notice that in terms of the Confederate government, they have the lowest amount of loans. And this is something that, for example, von Mises and I think Schumpeter both say that, you know, war is bad, obviously, but the best way to fight it is to try to get loans from foreign countries or in foreign economies, buy their resources, and ultimately pay the war off later on. So they were very unsuccessful in terms of getting loans. They also had the lowest amount of, or almost the lowest amount of taxes, except for the American Revolution. Basically, a very low level relying on taxes, which is also considered a good way to pay for war. And they relied the highest in the two worst categories. So in terms of their overall public finance strategy, the economic analysis that Austrians have offered suggests that their public finance, their mix of financing, was the worst possible way of going about it, providing additional evidence for the fact that economics is the determining factor, not military strategy or who's got the biggest barrel cannon and that kind of thing. So essentially we're trying to, and this is a book for historians and a book for students of history and graduate students in history, and the idea here is to, you know, it's fine to study battles, it's fine to study the lives of generals and specific battles, but in terms of understanding the war, and in this case its outcome, you have to remember that economic factors are paramount. One of the most important things, I think, for us is the monetary legacy of the Civil War. It really creates a sea change in monetary policy, or revolutionary change in monetary policy. As I laid out earlier, the situation in the United States prior to the war was one where the hard money advocates had the upper hand, where they had demonstrated and defeated the idea of a national bank, of paper currencies, where they had extinguished on a couple of occasions the national debt, where states had enacted bank prohibition laws against the use of unbacked paper banknotes, where gold and silver coins from around the world circulated as mediums of exchange. most states in the United States had free banking laws, which kept the government from heavily regulating banks or backing them up. And what we saw was not banks not with 100% reserve requirements, but banks with high capital ratios and high reserve ratios. They knew that they didn't have any support from the state or federal governments, and as a result, they were following prudent, conservative banking policies. Now, after the war, everything changes. We no longer have private currencies, gold and silver coins. We have the greenback era with a national currency. We no longer have state regulation or reduced state regulation. We have federal control of banking through the National Banking Act, which was enacted during the war as part of the issuing of greenback currencies. After the war, and there were certainly bank panics and business cycles before the war, but after the war, there was a series of banking panics, business cycles, and economic depressions. The contagion within the system actually increased. The national banking law was supposed to reduce this contagion effect amongst banks through federal regulation. What it actually did was to increase it. After the war, excuse me, there was a lot of organized opposition to federal tyranny in money and banking. There was the free silver movement, which sought to have the federal government start coining silver coins again. There was a tremendous, not a tremendous, but there was a shortage of gold coins and money after the Civil War as part of the process of organized deflation on the part of the federal government in terms of redeeming the greenbacks without replacing them in any way. There was the Greenback Political Party, which was organized around monetary issues. The Democratic Party, which was so strong, hard money, before the war, fell into the hands more of populists and progressives, ultimately progressives, William Jennings Bryan, and so on, that started to change the character of the Democratic Party and its position on money. As a matter of fact, they became sort of so pro money in the sense of increasing the money supply, and they had some reason for that, that the Republicans, who were the easy money policy, actually became known as the advocates for sound money and the gold standard. I want to give you a quote with respect to the National Banking Act, what it was supposed to do and what it actually ultimately ended up doing in the United States and the after effect of the war. We got three reputable mainstream monetary economists, Michael Bordeaux, Peter Rappaport, and Anna Schwartz, who studied the National Banking Act, who studied the money and banking system in the United States in the 19th century after the Civil War. And they found that any rationale for this system based on the public interest just could not be sustained, that there must have been private interests that supported and had the act put into place. And I quote on their conclusion that this system was a colossal failure. The provisions of the Acts of 1863 and 1865 that established the national banking system were designed to remedy two perceived defects of the antebellum state banking system. One was the circulation of a wide variety of state banknotes, often at a discount, which made for an inefficient payment system. The second defect was instability of the note issue, marked by overissue, bank runs and failures, and periodic suspension of convertibility into specie. To remedy the first defect, national bank issues of U.S. bond-secured currency replaced state banknotes. To remedy the second defect, stringent reserve and capital requirements, oversight, and regulation by the Comptroller of the Currency were conditions for national bank charters. Unfortunately, the remedies did not work as intended by the architects of the national banking system. Instead, the system was characterized by monetary and cyclical instability, four bank panics, frequent stock market crashes, and other financial disturbances. In other words, this revolutionary impact of the Civil War on American money and banking that was supposed to cure the defects of the antebellum money and banking system actually made things much worse. The only other thing that I think is, there's a couple of interesting points I guess I'll bring up here that you need to look for if you actually get a copy of the book and read the chapter. There's some discussion about where the term Dixieland came from. This is Dixie, especially for you foreigners, the land of Dixie, and it was a popular song before the Civil War, but nobody knows where it came from. And my research indicates, and other people have indicated this as well, that the origin of this was a $10 banknote issued by the Citizens Bank of Louisiana. The states around Louisiana were no banking states, where banking was prohibited. And so New Orleans was the only source of banking. It was a major source of commerce and international trade before the war. So that Louisiana banknotes circulated in Alabama, Mississippi, Texas, Arkansas, and on up the Ohio River. And one of the banknotes that circulated was this $10 French banknote from New Orleans. And of course the word 10 in French is D-I-X. And so these banknotes were referred to as Dixies. And so that's the, we think that the origin of the term and the origin of the song was based on this particular banknote, which is widely circulated. Now why would it be widely circulated when most banknotes were not trusted all that much? Well, in Louisiana they passed a law that required all banknotes to be backed by 33% reserves in gold, and the rest were to be backed by short-term securities. In other words, commercial paper that could only be for 90 days. So basically it was loan contracts or loan agreements for the exchange of commodities, cotton and sugar, which had a relatively stable value, instead of property. So you couldn't use this money to give mortgages on farms and things like that, which could possibly go bankrupt and not pay off the loans. But those short-term securities were almost as good as gold. The other thing that has a sort of a social tinge to it is the movie The Wizard of Oz. Y'all heard seen the movie The Wizard of Oz? And it's a very famous movie by Walt Disney, based on a very famous book written in 1900 by Frank Baum. And historians have come to realize that this book and this movie were actually written about the monetary disruptions and the monetary political opposition in the aftermath of the Civil War. So if you've seen the movie or read the book, they talk about the Emerald City, which is sort of the, you know, the city on the hill, and that refers to greenbacks from Washington, D.C. The yellow brick road, follow the yellow brick road, follow the yellow brick road, and you'll get to where you want to go, refers to the gold standard. The cure-all for everything in society, the cure for what the actors are trying to achieve, turns out to be the silver shoes, which is the silver movement, the free silver movement. And each of the characters in the movie, the Tin Man, the Scarecrow, the Cowardly Lion, all represent interest groups in society, farmers, manufacturers, and so on. And even there's even four characters. There's two good witches and two bad witches in the movie, and that turns out to be the Wicked Witch of the West and the Wicked Witch of the East. Those are the bad regions controlled by the federal government and the big city banks. And the Good Witch of the North and the Good Witch of the South, those are the areas that are being taken advantage of under the National Banking Act, where they don't have banks and they have shortages of money. And so it's kind of interesting how the monetary problems in the aftermath, as well as the monetary successes in the antebellum economy, get sort of surreptitiously integrated into society's culture. And I just thought I'd bring those up as sort of interesting points about what otherwise is a fairly dismal subject. Okay, we've got some time for questions or comments. Come on.
How would the distribution between loans, taxes, inflation, and other, how is that being done today with our Iraqi war?
Well, there's no special taxes. There's no special bonds. They haven't resorted to conscription of American soldiers yet, although they are preparing for that. They seem to me to be preparing for fairly long engagement over there, so all of this is subject to change. And whether or not they're actually confiscating Iraqi assets is something I can't really speak to. So basically, I would say that they're financing the war through paper and probably to a lesser degree on borrowing. To what extent the national debt is increasing or the deficit is increasing, it's kind of hard to say because we were already in a deficit and it was growing, and the war made that much worse. We can't even really tell at this point what the breakdown is, but it's definitely in terms of inflation and borrowing. Yes.
Didn't the union sort of avoid having to pay the piper, so to speak, by the fact that all of those greenbacks were circulating at the end of the war? And I mean, wasn't there a bust in what,
1873,
when all the greenbacks started coming back in, they had to default on all the loans, isn't that right?
Well, the both currencies, North and South, were going to be redeemable at some point in the future. A certain number of years after the war ended. And so that you could almost look at the currencies in terms of a loan. Now, the Southern currency, of course, is worthless at the end of the war. Although we point out in the beginning with a quote from another author that the Confederate currency has actually been appreciating since the Civil War and is now worth 8 times the value of the greenback. But after the war to 1873, they're in the process of redemption. They're in the process of trying to finance a return to the gold standard. And so as you move closer and closer to 1873, they're in a sense taking currency out of circulation. And the economy is experiencing price deflation along with monetary deflation. As a result, a lot of the plans that had developed over that period, the stringency, especially at the ultimate date of redemption, is what helps bring on the panic of 1873. And that whole period was kind of speckled with bank panics.
At this point, I always had in mind that there was no plan initially at all to ever redeem the greenbacks. And then, of course, there were always people pushing for it. But the official plans were made, and something was decided only in 1875, and the redemption started in 1879. So in 1873, they were not yet, I mean, maybe they started under that.
Yeah, they
do this. My interpretation of the crisis in 1873 was when they abolished.
That was. Yeah, that's right. Pre-coinage of silver.
So all silver was sucked out of the.
That's correct.
So that declenched a banking crisis.
That's correct. The crime of 1873. That's when they stopped minting silver coins and they moved completely to the gold standard. The redemption, although they were redeeming. But the ultimate redemption date was later than that.
Well, you recall Chase as Secretary of Treasury issued these things, and later as Supreme Court Justice, he says we were wrong. And in fact, he makes a famous decision which he repeated what he had himself done earlier. But the details don't come into mind. Do you remember that?
Well, I do know that, I mean, he's the one that came out with the idea, hey, we're sticking with the gold standard. He was a hard money man. We're sticking with the gold standard. The current taxes that we have will pay for the government that we already have, and the war effort will be paid through borrowing. And, you know, that basically didn't work. And the bonds that he was trying to float could not be sold, or at least sold in sufficient amounts. And so he had to back down. He was a pro gold guy and a hard money man, and I don't remember exactly what he said as a Supreme Court justice, but he was always against the idea of resorting to the greenbacks. He was very much opposed to that. I'm not surprised, because it wasn't his idea. He was forced into it.
Now, two critical questions about this. So I've been also intrigued about this question for quite a while, and I looked at it up in the case of World War I, when the German government, war finance of the German government was much more conservative, Austrian terms, than of the other governments. Still, England and France ultimately won the war. Also, if we look back in history, the English were usually much more ruthless in invading the money supply for war finance starting from the 18th century onward, also late 17th century, than the French, for example. And they usually won the wars. Now, I mean, there's certainly one thing that we do know from the theory of inflation, that it benefits the inflator. So certainly a government, at least in the short run, can benefit its position vis-à-vis other competing governments, especially in the war situation.
Mm-hmm.
You know that in the long run, if the whole thing wears on, the war takes 10 years, 20 years, and then final inflation, well, then of course the long run damages might be there and just undermine the position. But if they sort of say can win quickly enough, 1 year or 4 years or 5 years, then inflation might actually give them the competitive edge. So that would just be the sort of one critical difficulty here. And the other one, the other political question is, was the Southern economy was heavily based on slave labor. So here, the division of labor was not based on monetary exchanges. So doesn't this undermine your thesis that, that's not all of your thesis, right? I think the other point is, of course, that's a crucial one, which is that they get actually resources from outside to finance the war effort. That seems to be, I think that's a major consideration. I'm not so quite too sure about inflation, because also in the Southern economy, how could it have hurt them so much? It was based on slave labor, quite essentially.
Well, I mean, to start with the second one, slave labor was a marketable issue just as much as any other form of labor. Slaves were bought and sold at market prices, at auction prices, and they were rented out or leased out to all manner of work, including to the government for fortifications, but also to railroads, manufacturing plants, and all that had to be based on, you could hire for the day, you could hire for the week or the month, or you could lease for a year, and so.
How important was that market? I mean, as a percentage of all slave
It was pretty important, particularly during the war. There were phases of the Southern slave economy prior to the war, where you would see lots of slave labor moving to the cities, moving to industrial occupations, and then as the agricultural economy got hot, they would move back to the plantation. And there were cycles of that, and there were also cycles throughout the year where slaves would work on the plantation during the growing season and be leased out to the government for road building, railroad companies for laying track and repairing, things of that nature. During the war, there was a pretty sizable movement of slaves from the plantation working on agriculture into manufacturing. So it was all the value of slave labor was all market determined, and there was a pretty good flow of the slave labor, into and out of agriculture and manufacturing, government, private sector, or even the military. They worked for the military too. So the manufacturing people still had the problem of whether they hired free labor or slave labor as to how the wages or lease contract would fit into their economic calculation. Now the issue of inflation in war finance, that you bring up a good point, because you could, in many instances, I think you probably could win a war in the short run following any kind of financial arrangement. And it's been tried before. Of course, the Germans tried that. That was their whole idea in World War I, and I suppose World War II, was that they were going to strike quickly and effectively what otherwise was a formidable opponent. And it usually doesn't work, that sort of quick strike tactic ultimately doesn't work very well. Although I would say that if the Germans did pursue a good financial package during World War I, then I think that would hold up in the analysis, because I think they proved to be a very formidable army during that war with fairly weak allies. against a much larger opponent with more advanced economies. In other words, France, England, and the United States were more economically advanced than Austria and Turkey. And so Germany was really carrying the whole war effort for that side, I guess.
But I think in that particular case, your argument will still work, right? Because the war on for a long time, because of the forces, if they had reached the country additionally with inflation, it might have exhausted them actually before. So in that case, I would say actually your argument works. It would be good to say that the Germans could withstand longer
mm-hmm.
than they would have been able to withstand if they had used inflation to a higher degree. But effectively, they financed most of the war effort out of bonds. It was a relatively tiny bit of inflation, of course, I mean, major inflation rates, but nothing compared to the risk that was almost double or something. Even in the case of France, much more inflation.
Were they selling the bonds in the local?
Yes, so they couldn't attract any resources from outside.
Yeah, see, Mises says that the ideal thing is to sell those bonds
yes.
outside your economy and, well, basically go to foreign manufacturers and say, we want to buy your weapons and we'll pay you back later.
Well, so that worked to some extent with Sweden, Switzerland, but as soon as Italy entered into the war, there was no more exchange. They could trade with Switzerland, so, but they got some natural resources from steel in particular, from Sweden, and also sold bonds in Sweden. But I mean, so it is an interesting question because, I mean, surely we cannot reject the possibility out of hand that that is possible, right? You give yourself mm-hmm. a competitive edge in the short run. And if you manage to finish the war quickly enough, that was it. And one aspect that comes into play, or might come into play, is that the Brits actually always try to finish wars quickly. They always avoided long-running entanglements. The only major exception was the Napoleonic Wars. And even here, one could argue well that the Brits would have stayed out of the mess if Napoleon had not kept on fighting them.
Well, yeah, and it's a very interesting question. I think you know how could the South have avoided this? Most historians say that paper inflation was inevitable. And of course, that's always the claim that paper inflation is inevitable. But I don't think that that's really the case, because they relied so much on the central government, which was so new and disorganized. They already had pre-existing state governments that already had pre-existing militias that were well organized and armed. I think that if they had resorted to using the state government apparatus and military, it would have been resulted in a better military strategy as well as a better economic strategy, because they wouldn't have tried to extract so many resources and to keep so many resources out of the economy. I think that they should have gone after European resources with bonds backed up by land.
And they could not, right? Because of the blockade.
Well, and then they had to, that's the one thing that they should have done something about, was the blockade. And the initial plan was that they were going to do that with a small naval fleet, and blockade runners, privateers, letters of marque and reprisal, you know, all the private sorts of things. But none of the private things work if you don't have any open ports. And so when they dropped the idea of having a real navy, that whole blockade business disappeared. Joe?
Well, Stevens apparently tried to argue in 1861 that the Confederate government should somehow acquire a big chunk of the cotton crop issue 7% bonds against it and get it on votes as fast as they could before the Northern Blockade was effective and gotten this, these loans or whatever that you're talking about are just simple cash sales, which would have been gone to buying more farmers' records and so on. So once again, I think Stephen's slightly ahead of Davis and some of these guys.
Oh yeah, that would have been the that would have been the thing to do, but everybody was dead set against it. They wanted to keep the cotton here in the southern economy and try to get the Europeans to come get it and to intervene on behalf of the Confederate government, but they never really gave them an economic rationale to do that. So I think Stevens was right.
When was the U.S. Army located, the U.S. Navy located in which port at the beginning of the Civil War? When did the Union have to control the Navy?
Well, it wasn't a large Navy to begin with, and the Navy was located in places like Pensacola, Florida, Key West, Florida, New Orleans, Norfolk, Virginia, Philadelphia, New York, Boston, all of those cities had navies. And the Union either controlled or attacked most of the federal installations in the South. So they always controlled Pensacola, for example. They always controlled Key West. And Jacksonville, yeah. That wasn't much of a...
Does something to do with the fact that they got their revenue typically through tariffs, and all federal revenues were tariffs at the time?
Yeah, those were all.
So they had the loyal agents in these ports.
That could be the result in many instances. The big success of the blockade, though, had not much to do with the traditional Navy. The blockade fleet were Navy personnel, but they were paid on the basis of how much they captured. And so they were essentially privateers out there, and they didn't want to sink any of these boats because they were also profit motivated. But the Union made a very smart move by saying, whatever you capture, you get to keep, including the value of the boats and all the cargo. And whereas the Confederate government was constantly putting regulations and restrictions on these blockade runners. They were taxing the cotton going out. They were requiring the ships to transport materials for the government. They were restricting the types of things that they could bring in. And so where the Union government was just, you know, get whatever you can, boys, it's whatever you want. The Confederate government was actually hindering the efforts of the blockade runners, and in some places and times they were considered, the blockade runners were considered to be working for the opposition or to be undermining the war effort in what they were doing. So they were like in Gone with the Wind, of course. Rhett Butler is a blockade runner, and he's considered kind of tinged with the sort of the bad influence of being a blockade runner and making speculative profits on all this stuff. So it was the anti-capitalist mentality of the Confederacy which really hurt it in a number of different ways.
In the concluding remark about the Wizard of Oz, one great symbolism also highlights this, the affinity with the inflation theory, is that at the end, all figures get what they had from the first place. Right? For example, the girl, mm-hmm. She wants to get home to Kansas. Dorothy wants to get home to Kansas. The way to do it was just because she had the red shoes of the evil witch of Israel. So she could have, but she didn't have to get to the green bag. complex, right? And all others also similarly had already what they needed to succeed, to attain their end.
Yeah, they're given placebo type cures.
Placebo type of things.
Yeah.
So it's exactly what's going on, of course, with the paper money thing, right? All placebo.
The illusion.
Okay, thank you very much, Mark.
Great, thank you.